which forced me to sniff and unleashed what were not archangels, and Evelyn Lilith Burns, cause of a bicycle accident, who pushed me down a two-story hillock into the midst of history, and the monkey. I mustn't forget the monkey. But also there was Masha Miovich, goading me into finger loss, and my Auntie Pia, filling my heart with revenge lust, and Leela Sabarmati, whose indiscretions made possible my terrible manipulating newspaper cutout revenge, and Mrs. Dubash, who found my gift of a Superman comic and built it, with the help of her son, into Lord Khushro Khushrovand. And Mary, seeing a ghost. In Pakistan, the land of submission, the home of purity, I watched the transformation of monkey into singer, and fetched bread, and fell in love. It was a woman, Tai Bibi, who told me the truth about myself. And in the heart of my inner darkness, I turned to the Puffiers, and was only narrowly saved from the threat of a golden-dentured bride. Beginning again as the Buddha, I lay with a latrine cleaner, and was subjected to electrifying urinals as a result. In the East, a farmer's wife tempted me, and time was assassinated in consequence. And there were houris in a temple, and we only just escaped in time. In the shadow of a mosque, Reshim Bibi issued a warning, and I married Parvati the witch. "Oof, mister!" Padma exclaims. "That's too much women." I do not disagree, because I have not even included her, whose dreams of marriage and Kashmir have inevitably been leaking into me, making me wish, if only, so that, having once resigned myself to the cracks, I am now assailed by pangs of discontent, anger, fear, and regret. But above all, the widow. "I swear," Padma slaps her knee. "Too much, mister, too much." How are we to understand my too many women? As the multiple faces of Bharat Mata? Or as even more, as the dynamic aspect of Maya, as cosmic energy, which is represented as the female organ? Maya, in its dynamic aspect, is called Shakti. Perhaps it is no accident that, in the Hindu pantheon, the active power of a deity is contained within his queen. Maya Shakti mothers, but also muffles consciousness in its dream web. Too many women. Are they all aspects of Devi, the goddess, who is Shakti, who slew the buffalo demon, who defeated the ogre Mahisha, who is Kali Durga, Chandi, Chamunda, Uma, Sati, and Parvati, and who, when active, is coloured red? "I don't know about that," Padma brings me down to earth. "They are just women, that's all." Descending from my flight of fancy, I am reminded of the importance of speed. Driven on by the imperatives of rip, tear, crack, I abandon reflections and begin. This is how it came about. How Parvati took her destiny into her own hands, how a lie, issuing from my lips, brought her to the desperate condition in which, one night, she extracted from her shabby garments a lock of hero's hair and began to speak sonorous words. Spurned by Salim, Parvati remembered who had once been his archenemy and, taking a bamboo stick with 7 knots in it and an improvised metal hook attached to one end, she squatted in her shack and recited. With the hook of Indra in her right hand and a lock of hair in her left, she summoned him to her. Parvati called to Shiva. "Believe, don't believe," but Shiva came. From the beginning, there were knees and a nose and knees, but throughout this narrative, I've been pushing him, the other, into the background, just as once I banned him from the councils of the children. He can be concealed no longer, however, because one morning in May 1974, is it just my cracking memory, or am I right in thinking it was the 18th? Perhaps at the very moment at which the deserts of Rajasthan were being shaken by India's first nuclear explosion? Was Shiva's explosion into my life truly synchronous with India's arrival, without prior warning, at the nuclear age? He came to the magician's slum, uniformed, gonged and pipped, and a major now. Shiva alighted from an army motorcycle, and even through the modest khaki of his army pants, it was easy to make out the phenomenal twin bulges of his lethal knees. India's most decorated war hero. But once he led a gang of Apaches in the back streets of Bombay. Once, before he discovered the legitimized violence of war, prostitutes were found throttled in gutters. I know. No proof. Major Shiva now, but also wee Willy Winky's boy, who still remembered the words of long-silenced songs. Good night, ladies, still echoed on occasion in his ears. There are ironies here, which must not pass unnoticed, for had not Shiva risen as Salim fell? Who was the slum dweller now, and who looked down from commanding heights? There is nothing like a war for the reinvention of lives. On what may well have been May 18th, at any rate, Major Shiva came to the magician's ghetto and strode through the cruel streets of the slum with a strange expression on his face, which combined the infinite disdain for poverty of the recently exalted with something more mysterious. Because Major Shiva, drawn to our humble abode by the incantations of Parvati the witch, cannot have known what force impelled him to come. What follows is a reconstruction of the recent career of Major Shiva. I pieced the story together from Parvati's accounts, which I got out of her after our marriage. It seems my arch rival was fond of boasting to her about his exploits, so you may wish to make allowances for the distortions of truth which such chest-beating creates. However, there seems no reason to believe that what he told Parvati, and she repeated to me, was very far removed from what was the case. At the end of the war in the East, the legends of Shiva's awful exploits buzzed through the streets of the cities, leapt onto newspaper and into magazines, and thus insinuated themselves into the salons of the well-to-do, settling in clouds as thick as flies upon the eardrums of the country's hostesses. So that Shiva found himself elevated in social status as well as military rank, and was invited to 1,001 different gatherings, banquets, musical soirees, bridge parties, diplomatic receptions, party political conferences, great melas, and also smaller local fetes, school sports days and fashionable balls, to be applauded and monopolized by the noblest and fairest in the land, to all of whom the legends of his exploits clung like flies, walking over their eyeballs so that they saw the young man through the mist of his legend, coating their fingertips so that they touched him through the magical film of his myth, settling on their tongues so that they could not speak to him as they would to an ordinary human being. The Indian army, which was at that time fighting a political battle against proposed expenditure cuts, understood the value of so charismatic an ambassador, and permitted the hero to circulate amongst his influential admirers. Shiva espoused his new life with a will. He grew a luxuriant moustache, to which his personal Batman applied a daily pomade of linseed oil spiced with coriander. Always elegantly turned out in the drawing-rooms of the mighty, he engaged in political chit-chat and declared himself a firm admirer of Mrs. Gandhi, largely because of his hatred for her opponent Moraji Desai, who was intolerably ancient, drank his own urine, had skin which rustled like rice paper and, as Chief Minister of Bombay, had once been responsible for the banning of alcohol and the persecution of young Gundas, that is to say, hooligans, or Apaches, or in other words, of the child Shiva himself. But such idle chatter occupied a mere fraction of his thoughts, the rest of which were entirely taken up with the ladies. Shiva, too, was besotted by too much women, and in those heady days after the military victory, acquired a secret reputation which, he boasted to poverty, rapidly grew to rival his official public fame. A black legend to set beside the white one. What was whispered at the hen parties and canasta evenings of the land? What was hissed through giggles wherever two or three glittering ladies got together? This. Major Shiva was becoming a notorious seducer, a ladies' man, a cuckolder of the rich. In short, a stud. There were women, he told Parvati, wherever he went, their curving, bird-soft bodies quaking beneath the weight of their jewellery and lust, their eyes misted over by his legend. It would have been difficult to refuse them, even had he wanted to. But Major Shiva had no intention of refusing. He listened sympathetically to their little tragedies. Impotent husbands, beatings, lack of attention, to whatever excuses the lovely creatures wished to offer. Like my grandmother at her petrol pump, but with more sinister motives, he gave patient audience to their woes, sipping whiskey in the chandeliered splendour of ballrooms. He watched them batting their eyelids and breathing suggestively while they moaned. And always, at last, they contrived to drop a handbag or spill a drink or knock his swagger stick from his grasp, so that he would have to stoop to the floor to retrieve whatever had fallen. And then he would see the notes tucked into their sandals, sticking daintily out from under painted toes. In those days, if the major is to be believed, the lovely, scandalous Begums of India became awfully clumsy, and their chapels spoke of rendezvous at midnights, of trellises of bougainvillea outside bedroom windows, of husbands conveniently away launching ships, or exporting tea, or buying ball bearings from Swedes. While these unfortunates were away, the major visited their homes to steal their most prized possessions. Their women fell into his arms. It is possible, I have divided by half the major's own figures, that at the height of his philanderings there were no less than 10,000 women in love with him. And certainly there were children, the spawn of illicit midnights, beautiful, bouncing infants secure in the cradles of the rich, strewing bastards across the map of India. The war hero went his way, but, and this too is what he told Parvati, he suffered from the curious fault of losing interest in anyone who became pregnant, no matter how beautiful, sensuous, loving they were. He deserted the bedrooms of all who bore his children, and lovely ladies with red-rimmed eyes were obliged to persuade their cuckolded husbands that, yes, of course, it's your baby, darling life of mine. Doesn't it look just like you? And, of course, I'm not sad. Why should I be? These are tears of joy. One such deserted mother was Roshanara, the child wife of the steel magnate S.P. Shetty, and at the Mahalakshmi racecourse in Bombay, she punctured the mighty balloon of his pride. He had been promenading about the paddock, stooping every few yards to return ladies' shawls and parasols, which seemed to acquire a life of their own, and spring out of their owner's hands as he passed. Roshanara Shetty confronted him here, standing squarely in his path and refusing to budge, her 17-year-old eyes filled with the ferocious pique of childhood. He greeted her coolly, touching his army cap, and attempted to pass. But she dug her needle-sharp nails into his arm, smiling dangerously as ice, and strolled along beside him. As they walked, she poured her infantile poison into his ear, and her hatred and resentment of her former lover gave her the skill to make him believe her. Callously, she whispered that it was so funny, my God, the way he strutted around in high society like some kind of rooster, while all the time the ladies were laughing at him behind his back. Oh, yes, Major Saab, don't fool yourself. High-class women have always enjoyed sleeping with animals, peasants, brutes. But that's how we think of you. My God, it's disgusting just to watch you eat. gravy down your chin. Don't you think we see how you never hold teacups by their handles? Do you imagine we can't hear your belches and breakings of wind? You're just our pet ape, Major Saab. Very useful, but basically a clown. After the onslaught of Roshanara Shetty, the young war hero began to see his world differently. Now he seemed to see women giggling behind fans wherever he went. He noticed strange, amused, sidelong glances, which he'd never noticed before. And although he tried to improve his behaviour, it was no use. He seemed to become clumsier the harder he tried, so that food flew off his plate onto priceless Kelim rugs, and belches broke from his throat with the roar of a train emerging from a tunnel, and he broke wind with the rage of typhoons. His glittering new life became for him a daily humiliation, and now he reinterpreted the advances of the beautiful ladies, understanding that by placing their love notes beneath their toes, they were obliging him to kneel demeaningly at their feet. As he learned that a man may possess every manly attribute and still be despised for not knowing how to hold a spoon, he felt an old violence being renewed in him, a hatred for these high-ups and their power. Which is why, I am sure, why I know, that when the emergency offered Shiva of the Knees the chance of grabbing some power for himself, he did not wait to be asked a second time. On May 15, 1974, Major Shiva returned to his regiment in Delhi. He claimed that 3 days later he was suddenly seized by a desire to see once more the saucer-eyed beauty whom he had first encountered long ago in the Conference of the Midnight Children, the ponytailed temptress who had asked him in Dhaka for a single lock of his hair. Major Shiva declared to Parvati that his arrival at the magician's ghetto had been motivated by a desire to be done with the rich bitches of Indian high society, that he had been besotted by her pouting lips the moment he had laid eyes on them, and that these were the only reasons for asking her to go away with him. But I have already been over-generous to Major Shiva. In this, my own personal version of history, I have allowed his account too much space, so I insist that, whatever the knock-kneed Major might have thought, the thing that drew him into the ghetto was quite simply and straightforwardly the magic of Parvati the Witch. Salim was not in the ghetto when Major Shiva arrived by motorcycle, while nuclear explosions rocked the Rajasthani wastes out of sight. Beneath the desert surface, the explosion which changed my life also took place out of my sight. When Shiva grasped Parvati by the wrist, I was with Picture Singh at an emergency conference of the city's many red cells, discussing the ins and outs of the national railway strike, when Parvati, without demurring, took her place on the pillion of a hero's Honda. I was busily denouncing the government's arrests of union leaders. In short, while I was preoccupied with politics and my dream of national salvation, the powers of Parvati's witchcraft had set in motion the scheme which would end with hennaed palms and songs and the signing of a contract. I am obliged, perforce, to rely on the accounts of others. Only Shiva could tell what had befallen him. It was Reshim Bibi who described Parvati's departure to me on my return, saying, "Poor girl, let her go. So sad she has been for so long. What is to blame?" And only Parvati could recount to me what befell her while she was away. Because of the Major's national status as a war hero, he was permitted to take certain liberties with military regulations, so nobody took him to task for importing a woman into what were not, after all, married men's quarters. And he, not knowing what had brought about this remarkable alteration in his life, sat down as requested in a cane chair, while she took off his boots, pressed his feet, brought him water flavoured with freshly squeezed limes, dismissed his batman, oiled his moustache, caressed his knees, and after all that produced a dinner of biryani so exquisite that he stopped wondering what was happening to him and began to enjoy it instead. Parvati the Witch turned those simple army quarters into a palace, a Kailasa fit for Shiva the god, and Major Shiva, lost in the haunted pools of her eyes, aroused beyond endurance by the erotic protrusion of her lips, devoted his undivided attention to her for 4 whole months. Or to be precise, for 117 nights. On September 12th, however, things changed, because Parvati, kneeling at his feet, fully aware of his views on the subject, told him that she was going to have his child. The liaison of Shiva and Parvati now became a tempestuous business, filled with blows and broken plates, an earthly echo of that eternal marital battle of the gods, which their namesakes are said to perform atop Mount Kailasa in the great Himalayas. Major Shiva at this time began to drink, also to whore. The whoring trails of the war hero around the capital of India bore a strong resemblance to the Lambretta travels of Salim Sanai along the spores of Karachi streets. Major Shiva, unmanned in the company of the rich by the revelations of Roshanara Shetty, had taken to paying for his pleasures. And such was his phenomenal fecundity, he assured Parvati, while beating her, that he ruined the careers of many a loose woman by giving them babies whom they would love too much to expose. He sired around the capital an army of street urchins to mirror the regiment of bastards he had fathered on the begums of the chandeliered salons. Dark clouds were gathering in political skies as well, in Bihar, where corruption, inflation, hunger, illiteracy, landlessness ruled the roost. Jaya Prakash Narayan led a coalition of students and workers against the governing Indira Congress. In Gujarat, there were riots, railway trains were burned, and Morarji Desai went on a fast unto death to bring down the corrupt government of the Congress under Chimanbhai Patel in that drought-ridden state. It goes without saying that he succeeded without being obliged to die. In short, while anger seethed in Shiva's mind, the country was getting angry too. And what was being born while something grew in Parvati's belly? You know the answer. In late 1974, J.P. Narayan and Morarji Desai formed the opposition party known as the Janata Morcha, the People's Front. While Major Shiva reeled from whore to whore, the Indira Congress was reeling too. And at last, Parvati released him from her spell. No other explanation will do. If he was not bewitched, why did he not cast her off the instant he heard of her pregnancy? And if the spell had not been lifted, how could he have done it at all? Shaking his head, as though awaking from a dream, Major Shiva found himself in the company of a balloon-fronted slum girl, who now seemed to him to represent everything he most feared. She became the personification of the slums of his childhood, from which he had escaped, and which now, through her damnable child, were trying to drag him down, down, down again. Dragging her by the hair, he hurled her onto his motorcycle, and in a very short time she stood, abandoned, on the fringes of the magician's ghetto, having been returned whence she came. Bringing with her only one thing which she had not owned when she left, the thing hidden inside her like an invisible man in a wicker basket, the thing which was growing, 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 just as she had planned. Why do I say that? Because it must be true, because what followed, followed. Because it is my belief that Parvati the witch became pregnant in order to invalidate my only defense against marrying her. But I shall only describe and leave analysis to posterity. On a cold day in January, when the muezzin's cries from the highest minaret of the Friday mosque froze as they left his lips and fell upon the city as sacred snow, Parvati returned. She had waited until there could be no possible doubt about her condition. Her inner basket bulged through the clean new garments of Shiva's now defunct infatuation. Her lips, sure of their coming triumph, had lost their fashionable pout. In her saucer eyes, as she stood on the steps of the Friday mosque to ensure that as many people as possible saw her changed appearance, there lurked a silvered gleam of contentment. That was how I found her when I returned to the chaya of the mosque with Picture Singh. I was feeling disconsolate, and the sight of Parvati the witch on the steps, hands folded calmly over her swollen belly, long rope of hair blowing gently in the crystal air, did nothing to cheer me up. Picture G and I had gone into the tapering tenement streets behind the general post office, where memories of fortune-tellers, peep-show men, healers hung in the breeze. And here Picture Singh had performed an act which was growing more political by the day. His legendary artistry drew large, good-natured crowds, and he made his snakes enact his message under the influence of his weaving flute music. While I, in my role of apprentice, read out a prepared harangue, serpents dramatized my speech. I spoke of the gross iniquities of wealth distribution. Two cobras performed in dumb show the mime of a rich man refusing to give alms to a beggar. Police harassment, hunger, disease, illiteracy were spoken of, and also danced by serpents. And then, Picture Singh, concluding his act, began to talk about the nature of red revolution. And promises began to fill the air, so that even before the police materialized out of the back doors of the post office to break up the meeting with lathi charges and tear gas, certain wags in our audience had begun to heckle the most charming man in the world. Unconvinced, perhaps, by the ambiguous mimes of the snakes, whose dramatic content was admittedly a little obscure, a youth shouted out, "Oh, hey, Picture G, you should be in the government, man. Not even Indra Mata makes promises as nice as yours." Then the tear gas came, and we had to flee, coughing, spluttering, blind, from riot police like criminals, crying falsely as we ran, just as once in Jallianwala Bagh. But at least there were no bullets on this occasion. But although the tears were the tears of gas, Picture Singh was indeed cast down into an awesome gloom by the heckler's jibe, which had questioned the hold on reality which was his greatest pride. And in the aftermath of gas and sticks, I too was dejected, having suddenly identified a moth of unease in my stomach, and realized that something in me objected to Picture's portrayal in Snake Dance of the unrelieved vileness of the rich. I found myself thinking, there is good and bad in all, and they brought me up, they looked after me, Picture G. After which I began to see that the crime of Mary Pereira had detached me from two worlds, not one, that having been expelled from my uncle's house, I could never fully enter the world according to Picture Singh, that, in fact, my dream of saving the country was a thing of mirrors and smoke, insubstantial, the maunderings of a fool. And then there was Parvati, with her altered profile in the harsh clarity of the winter day. It was, or am I wrong? I must rush on. Things are slipping from me all the time, a day of horrors. It was then, unless it was another day, that we found old Resham Bibi dead of cold, lying in her hut, which she had built out of Dalda Vanasapati packing cases. She had turned bright blue, Krishna blue, blue as Jesus, the blue of Kashmiri sky, which sometimes leaks into eyes. We burned her on the banks of the Jamuna, among mudflats and buffalo. And she missed my wedding as a result, which was sad, because like all old women, she loved weddings, and had in the past joined in the preliminary henna ceremonies with energetic glee, leading the formal singing in which the bride's friends insulted the groom and his family. On one occasion, her insults had been so brilliant and finely calculated that the groom took umbrage and cancelled the wedding. But Resham had been undaunted, saying that it wasn't her fault if young men nowadays were as faint-hearted and inconstant as chickens. I was absent when Parvati went away. I was not present when she returned. And there was one more curious fact, unless I have forgotten, unless it was on another day. It seems to me, at any rate, that on the day of Parvati's return, an Indian cabinet minister was in his railway carriage at Samastipur when an explosion blew him into the history books. That Parvati, who had departed amid the explosions of atom bombs, returned to us when Mr. L. N. Mishra, Minister for Railways and Bribery, departed this world for good. Omens and more omens. Perhaps in Bombay, dead pomfrets were floating belly side up to shore. January 26th, Republic Day, is a good time for illusionists, when the huge crowds gather to watch elephants and fireworks, the city tricksters go out to earn their living, For me, however, the day holds another meaning. It was on Republic Day that my conjugal fate was sealed. In the days after Parvati's return, the old women of the ghetto formed the habit of holding their ears for shame whenever they passed her. She, who bore her illegitimate child without any appearance of guilt, would smile innocently and walk on. But on the morning of Republic Day, she awoke to find a rope hung with tattered shoes strung above her door, and began to weep inconsolably, her poise disintegrating under the force of this greatest of insults. Picture Singh and I, leaving our shack laden with baskets of snakes, came across her in her calculated, genuine misery, and Picture Singh set his jaw in an attitude of determination.
"Come back to the hut, Captain," the most charming man instructed me. "We must talk."
And in the hut,
"Forgive me, Captain, but I must speak. I am thinking it is a terrible thing for a man to go through life without children. To have no son, Captain, how sad for you, is it not?"
And I, trapped by the lie of impotence, remained silent while Picture G suggested the marriage which would preserve Parvati's honour and simultaneously solve the problem of my self-confessed sterility. And despite my fears of the face of Jamila Singha, which, superimposed on Parvati's, had the power of driving me to distraction, I could not find it in myself to refuse. Parvati, just as she had planned, I'm sure, accepted me at once, said yes as easily and as often as she had said no in the past. And after that, the Republic Day celebrations acquired the air of having been staged especially for our benefit. But what was in my mind was that once again, destiny, inevitability, the antithesis of choice had come to rule my life. Once again, a child was to be born to a father who was not his father, although, by a terrible irony, the child would be the true grandchild of his father's parents. Trapped in the web of these interweaving genealogies, it may even have occurred to me to wonder what was beginning, what was ending, and whether another secret countdown was in progress, and what would be born with my child. Despite the absence of Reshim Bibi, the wedding went off well enough. Parvati's formal conversion to Islam, which irritated Picture Singh, but on which I found myself insisting in another throwback to an earlier life, was performed by a red-bearded Haji, who looked ill at ease in the presence of so many teasing, provocative members of the ungodly. Under the shifting gaze of this fellow, who resembled a large and bearded onion, she intoned her belief that there was no God but God, and that Muhammad was his prophet. She took a name which I chose for her out of the repository of my dreams, becoming Layla, Night, so that she too was caught up in the repetitive cycles of my history, becoming an echo of all the other people who have been obliged to change their names. Like my own mother, Amina Sanai, Parvati the Witch became a new person in order to have a child. At the henna ceremony, half the magicians adopted me, performing the functions of my family. The other half took Parvati's side, and happy insults were sung late into the night while intricate traceries of henna dried into the palms of her hands and the soles of her feet. And if the absence of Reshim Bibi deprived the insults of a certain cutting edge, we were not overly sorry about the fact. During the nikah, the wedding proper, the happy couple were seated on a dais hastily constructed out of the dalda boxes of Reshim's demolished shack, and the magicians filed solemnly past us, dropping coins of small denominations into our laps. And when the new Layla Sinai fainted, everyone smiled contentedly, because every good bride should faint at her wedding, and nobody mentioned the embarrassing possibility that she might have passed out because of the nausea, or perhaps the kicking pains caused by the child inside her basket. That evening, the magicians put on a show so wonderful that rumours of it spread throughout the old city, and crowds gathered to watch. Muslim businessmen from a nearby muhalla, in which once a public announcement had been made, and silversmiths and milkshake vendors from Chandni Chowk, evening strollers and Japanese tourists who all, on this occasion, wore surgical face masks out of politeness so as not to infect us with their exhaled germs, and there were pink Europeans discussing camera lenses with the Japanese, There were shutters clicking and flashbulbs popping, and I was told by one of the tourists that India was indeed a truly wonderful country with many remarkable traditions and would be just fine and perfect if one did not constantly have to eat Indian food. And at the Valima, the consummation ceremony, at which on this occasion no bloodstained sheets were held up, with or without perforations, since I had spent our nuptial night with my eyes shut tight and my body averted from my wife's, lest the unbearable features of Jamila Singha come to haunt me in the bewilderment of the dark, the magicians surpassed their efforts of the wedding night. But when all the excitement had died down, I heard, with one good and one bad ear, the inexorable sound of the future stealing up upon us, tick-tock, louder and louder, until the birth of Salim Sanai, and also of the baby's father, found a mirror in the events of the night of the 25th of June. While mysterious assassins killed government officials and narrowly failed to get rid of Mrs. Gandhi's personally chosen Chief Justice, A.N. Ray, the magician's ghetto concentrated on another mystery, the ballooning basket of Parvati the Witch. While the Janata Morcha grew in all kinds of bizarre directions, until it embraced Maoist communists, such as our very own contortionists, including the rubber-limbed triplets with whom Parvati had lived before our marriage. Since the nuptials, we had moved into a hut of our own, which the ghetto had built for us as a wedding present on the site of Resham's hovel, and extreme right-wing members of the Ananda Marg, until left socialists and conservative Swatantra members joined its ranks, while the People's Front expanded in this grotesque manner, I, Salim, wondered incessantly about what might be growing behind the expanding frontage of my wife. While public discontent with the Indra Congress threatened to crush the government like a fly, the brand new Leila Sanai, whose eyes had grown wider than ever, sat as still as a stone, while the weight of the baby increased until it threatened to crush her bones to powder. And Picture Singh, in an innocent echo of an ancient remark, said, "Hey, Captain, it's going to be big, a real 10-chip whopper for sure." And then it was the 12th of June. History books, newspapers, radio programs tell us that at 2 p.m. on June 12th, Prime Minister Indira Gandhi was found guilty by Judge Jagmohan Lal Sinha of the Allahabad High Court of two counts of campaign malpractice during the election campaign of 1971. What has never previously been revealed is that it was at precisely 2 p.m. that Parvati the Witch, now Leila Sanai, became sure she had entered labor. The labour of Parvati Leila lasted for 13 days. On the first day, while the Prime Minister was refusing to resign, although her convictions carried with them a mandatory penalty, barring her from public office for 6 years, the cervix of Parvati the Witch, despite contractions as painful as mule kicks, obstinately refused to dilate. Salim Sanai and Picture Singh, barred from the hut of her torment by the contortionist triplets who had taken on the duties of midwives, were obliged to listen to her useless shrieks until a steady stream of fire-eaters, card-sharpers, coal-walkers came up and slapped them on the back and made dirty jokes. And it was only in my ears that the ticking could be heard, a countdown to God knows what, until I became possessed by fear and told Picture Singh, "I don't know what's going to come out of her, but it isn't going to be good." And Picture G reassuringly,
"Don't you worry, Captain. Everything will be fine. A 10-chip whopper, I swear."
And Parvati screaming, and night fading into day. And on the second day, when in Gujarat Mrs. Gandhi's electoral candidates were routed by the Janata Morcha, my Parvati was in the grip of pain so intense that they made her as stiff as steel, and I refused to eat until the baby was born, or whatever happened. I sat cross-legged outside the hovel of her agony, shaking with terror in the heat, begging, "Don't let her die, don't let her die," although I had never made love to her during all the months of our marriage. In spite of my fear of the spectre of Jamila Singha, I prayed and fasted, although Picture Singh, "For pity's sake, Captain," I refused, and by the ninth day the ghetto had fallen into a terrible hush, a silence so absolute that not even the calls of the muezzin of the mosque could penetrate it. a soundlessness of such immense powers that it shut out the roars of the Janata Morcha demonstration outside Rashtrapati Bhavan, the president's house. A horror-struck muteness of the same awful enveloping magic as the great silence which had once hung over my grandparents' house in Agra. So that, on the ninth day, we could not hear Moraji Desai calling on President Ahmed to sack the disgraced Prime Minister, and the only sounds in the entire world were the ruined whimperings of Parvati Leela, as the contractions piled upon her like mountains, and she sounded as though she were calling to us down a long, hollow tunnel of pain, while I sat cross-legged, being dismembered by her agony, with the soundless sound of tick-tock in my brain. And inside the hut, there were the contortionist triplets pouring water over Parvati's body to replenish the moisture which was pouring out of her in fountains, forcing a stick between her teeth to prevent her from biting out her tongue, and trying to force down her eyelids over her eyes, which were bulging so frighteningly that the triplets were afraid they would fall out and get dirty on the floor. And then it was the 12th day, and I was half dead of starvation, while elsewhere in the city the Supreme Court was informing Mrs. Gandhi that she need not resign until her appeal, but must neither vote in the Lok Sabha nor draw a salary. And while the Prime Minister, in her exultation at this partial victory, began to abuse her opponents in language of which a Kohli fishwife would have been proud, my Parvati's labour entered a phase in which, despite her utter exhaustion, she found the energy to issue a string of foul-smelling oaths from her colour-drained lips, so that the cesspit stink of her obscenities filled our nostrils and made us retch. And the three contortionists fled from the hut, crying that she had become so stretched, so colourless, that you could almost see through her, and she would surely die if the baby did not come now. And in my ears, tick-tock, the pounding tick-tock, until I was sure, yes, soon, soon, soon. And when the triplets returned to her bedside in the evening of the 13th day, they screamed, yes, yes! She has begun to push. Come on, Parvati, push, push, push. And while Parvati pushed in the ghetto, J.P. Narayan and Moraji Desai were also goading Indira Gandhi. While triplets yelled, push, 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 the leaders of the Janata Morcha urged the police and army to disobey the illegal orders of the disqualified Prime Minister. So, in a sense, they were forcing Mrs. Gandhi to push, and as the night darkened towards the midnight hour, because nothing ever happens at any other time, triplets began to screech, "It's coming, coming, coming!" And elsewhere the Prime Minister was giving birth to a child of her own. In the ghetto, in the hut beside which I sat cross-legged and starving to death, my son was coming, coming, coming. The head is out, the triplets screeched, while members of the Central Reserve Police arrested the heads of the Janata Morcha, including the impossibly ancient and almost mythological figures of Moraji Desai and J.P. Narayan. Push, push, push! And in the heart of that terrible midnight, while tick-tock pounded in my ears, a child was born, a 10-chip whopper all right, popping out so easily in the end that it was impossible to understand what all the trouble had been. Parvati gave a final, pitiable little yelp, and out he popped, while all over India policemen were arresting people. All opposition leaders except members of the pro-Moscow communists, and also school teachers, lawyers, poets, newspapermen, trade unionists, in fact, anyone who had ever made the mistake of sneezing during the madam's speeches. And when the three contortionists had washed the baby and wrapped it in an old sari and brought it out for its father to see, at exactly the same moment the word emergency was being heard for the first time. And suspension of civil rights, and censorship of the press, and armoured units on special alert, and arrest of subversive elements. Something was ending. Something was being born. And at the precise instant of the birth of the new India and the beginning of a continuous midnight which would not end for 2 long years, my son, the child of the renewed tick-tock, came out into the world. And there is more, Because when, in the murky half-light of that endlessly prolonged midnight, Salim Sanai saw his son for the first time, he began to laugh helplessly, his brain ravaged by hunger, yes, but also by the knowledge that his relentless destiny had played yet another of its grotesque little jokes. And although Picture Singh, scandalized by my laughter, which in my weakness was like the giggling of a schoolgirl, cried repeatedly, "Come on, Captain, don't behave mad now. It's a son, Captain, be happy." Salim Sanai continued to acknowledge the birth by tittering hysterically at fate, because the boy, the baby boy, the boy my son Adam, Adam Sanai, was perfectly formed, except, that is, for his ears. On either side of his head flapped audient protuberances like sails, ears so colossally huge that the triplets afterwards revealed that when his head popped out, they had thought, for one bad moment, that it was the head of a tiny elephant.
"Captain Salim, Captain!" Picture Singh was begging. "Be nice now. Oh, ears are not anything to go crazy for."
He was born in Old Delhi. Once upon a time. No, that won't do. There's no getting away from the date. Adam Sanai arrived at a night-shadowed slum on June 25th, 1975. And the time? The time matters too. As I said, at night. No, it's important to be more... On the stroke of midnight, as a matter of fact. Clock, hands, joined palms. Oh, spell it out! Spell it out! At the precise instant of India's arrival at emergency, he emerged. There were gasps, and across the country, silences and fears. Owing to the occult tyrannies of that benighted hour, he was mysteriously handcuffed to history, his destinies indissolubly chained to those of his country. Unprophesied, uncelebrated, he came. No prime ministers wrote him letters, but, just the same, as my time of connection neared its end, his began. He, of course, was left entirely without a say in the matter. After all, he couldn't even wipe his own nose at the time. He was the child of a father who was not his father, but also the child of a time which damaged reality so badly that nobody ever managed to put it together again. He was the true great-grandson of his great-grandfather, but elephantiasis attacked him in the ears instead of the nose, because he was also the true son of Shiva and Parvati. He was elephant-headed Ganesh. He was born with ears which flapped so high and wide that they must have heard the shootings in Bihar and the screams of lathi-charged dock workers in Bombay. A child who heard too much, and as a result, never spoke, rendered dumb by a surfeit of sound, so that between then and now, from slum to pickle factory, I have never heard him utter a single word. He was the possessor of a navel which chose to stick out instead of in, so that Picture Singh, aghast, cried,
"His bimbi, Captain! His bimbi, look!"
And he became, from the first days, the gracious recipient of our awe. A child of such grave good nature that his absolute refusal to cry or whimper utterly won over his adoptive father, who gave up laughing hysterically at the grotesque ears and began to rock the silent infant gently in his arms. A child who heard a song as he rocked in arms, a song sung in the historical accents of a disgraced ayah. "Anything you want to be, you can be. You can be just what all you want." But now that I've given birth to my flap-eared, silent son, there are questions to be answered about that other synchronous birth. Unpalatable, awkward queries. Did Salim's dream of saving the nation leak through the osmotic tissues of history into the thoughts of the Prime Minister herself? Was my lifelong belief in the equation between the state and myself transmuted in the madam's mind into that, in those days, famous phrase, "India is Indra, and Indra is India"? Were we competitors for centrality? Was she gripped by a lust for meaning as profound as my own? And was that why? Influence of hairstyles on the course of history. There's another ticklish business. If William Methold lacked a scent of parting, I might not have been here today. And if the mother of the nation had had a coiffure of uniform pigment, the emergency she spawned might easily have lacked a darker side. But she had white hair on one side and black on the other. The emergency, too, had a white part, public, visible, documented, a matter for historians, and a black part, which, being secret, macabre, untold, must be a matter for us. Mrs. Indira Gandhi was born in November 1917 to Kamala and Jawaharlal Nehru. Her middle name was Priyadarshini. She was not related to Mahatma M.K. Gandhi. Her surname was the legacy of her marriage in 1942 to one Feroz Gandhi, who became known as the nation's son-in-law. They had two sons, Rajiv and Sanjay. But in 1949, she moved back into her father's home and became his official hostess. Feroz made one attempt to live there too, but it was not a success. He became a ferocious critic of the Nehru government, exposing the Mundra scandal and forcing the resignation of the then finance minister, T.T. Krishnamachari, T.T.K. himself. Mr. Feroz Gandhi died of a heart seizure in 1960, aged 47. Sanjay Gandhi and his ex-model wife Menaka were prominent during the emergency. The Sanjay youth movement was particularly effective in the sterilization campaign. I have included this somewhat elementary summary just in case you had failed to realize that the Prime Minister of India was, in 1975, 15 years a widow, or, because the capital letter may be of use, a widow. Yes, Padma, Mother Indira really had it in for me. Midnight. No, but I must. I don't want to tell it, but I swore to tell it all. No, I renounce. Not that. Surely some things are better left. That won't wash. What can't be cured must be endured. But surely not the whispering walls and treason and snip, snip and the women with the bruised chests? Especially those things. But how can I? Look at me. I'm tearing myself apart. Can't even agree with myself. Talking, arguing like a wild fellow, cracking up. Memory going, yes, memory plunging into chasms and being swallowed by the dark. Only fragments remain. None of it makes sense anymore. But I mustn't presume to judge. Must simply continue, having once begun until the end. Sense and nonsense is no longer, perhaps never was, for me to evaluate. But the horror of it, I can't, won't, mustn't, won't, can't, no! Stop this, begin, no! Yes! About the dream, then. I might be able to tell it as a dream, yes. Perhaps a nightmare. Green and black, the widow's hair, and clutching hand, and children, and little balls, and one by one, and torn in half, and little balls go flying, flying green and black. Her hand is green, her nails are black as black. No, dreams. Neither the time nor the place for facts as remembered. To the best of one's ability, the way it was, begin. No choice, none. When was there ever? There are imperatives and logical consequences and inevitabilities and recurrences. There are things done to and accidents and bludgeonings of fate. When was there ever a choice? When options? When a decision freely made to be this or that or the other? No choice. Begin, yes. Listen, Endless night, days, weeks, months without the sun, or rather, because it's important to be precise, beneath a sun as cold as a stream-rinsed plate, a sun washing us in lunatic midnight light. I'm talking about the winter of 1975-6. In the winter, darkness and also tuberculosis. Once, in a blue room, overlooking the sea, beneath the pointing finger of a fisherman, I fought typhoid and was rescued by snake poison. Now, trapped in the dynastic webs of recurrence by my recognition of his sonship, our Adam Sinai was also obliged to spend his early months battling the invisible snakes of a disease. The serpents of tuberculosis wound themselves around his neck and made him gasp for air. But he was a child of ears and silence. And when he spluttered, there were no sounds. When he wheezed, no raspings issued from his throat. In short, my son fell ill, and although his mother, Parvati or Layla, went in search of the herbs of her magical gift, although infusions of herbs in well-boiled water were constantly administered, the wraith-like worms of tuberculosis refused to be driven away. I suspected from the first something darkly metaphorical in this illness, believing that in those midnight months when the age of my connection to history overlapped with his, our private emergency was not unconnected with the larger macrocosmic disease, under whose influence the sun had become as pallid and diseased as our sun. Parvati then, like Padma now, dismissed these abstract ruminations, attacking as mere folly my growing obsession with light, in whose grip I began lighting little dial lamps in the shack of my son's illness, filling our hut with candle flames at noon. But I insist on the accuracy of my diagnosis. I tell you, I insisted then, while the emergency lasts, he will never become well. Driven to distraction by her failure to cure that grave child who never cried, my Parvati Layla refused to believe my pessimistic theories. But she became vulnerable to every other cockeyed notion. When one of the older women in the colony of the magicians told her, as Reshim Bibi might have, that the illness could not come out while the child remained dumb, Parvati seemed to find that plausible. "Sickness is a grief of the body," she lectured me. "It must be shaken off in tears and groans." That night she returned to the hut, clutching a little bundle of green powder, wrapped in newspaper and tied up with pale pink string, and told me that this was a preparation of such power that it would oblige even a stone to shriek. When she administered the medicine, the child's cheeks began to bulge, as though his mouth were full of food. The long-suppressed sounds of his babyhood flooded up behind his lips, and he jammed his mouth shut in fury. It became clear that the infant was close to choking as he tried to swallow back the torrential vomit of pent-up sound which the green powder had stirred up. And this was when we realized that we were in the presence of one of the Earth's most implacable wills. At the end of an hour, during which my son turned first saffron, then saffron and green, and finally the colour of grass, I could not stand it any more and bellowed, "Woman, if the little fellow wants so much to stay quiet, we mustn't kill him for it." I picked up Adam to rock him and felt his little body becoming rigid. His knee joints, elbows, neck were filling up with the held-back tumult of unexpressed sounds. And at last, Parvati relented and prepared an antidote by mashing arrowroot and chamomile in a tin bowl while muttering strange imprecations under her breath. After that, nobody ever tried to make Adam Sinai do anything he did not wish to do. We watched him battling against tuberculosis and tried to find reassurance in the idea that a will so steely would surely refuse to be defeated by any mere disease. In those last days, my wife, Layla, or Parvati, was also being gnawed by the interior moths of despair. Because when she came towards me for comfort or warmth in the isolation of our sleeping hours, I still saw superimposed upon her features the horribly eroded physiognomy of Jamila Singer. And although I confess to Parvati the secret of the spectre consoling her by pointing out that at its present rate of decay it would have crumbled away entirely before long, she told me dolorously that spittoons and war had softened my brain, and despaired of a marriage which would, as it transpired, never be consummated. Slowly, slowly there appeared on her lips the ominous pout of her grief. But what could I do? What solace could I offer? I, Salim, Snotnose, who had been reduced to poverty by the withdrawal of my family's protection, who had chosen, if it was a choice, to live by my olfactory gifts, earning a few paisa a day by sniffing out what people had eaten for dinner the previous day, and which of them were in love, what consolation could I bring her, when I was already in the clutches of the cold hand of that lingering midnight, and could sniff finality in the air? Salim's nose, you can't have forgotten, could smell stranger things than horse dung. The perfumes of emotions and ideas, the odour of how things were, all these were and are nosed out by me with ease. When the constitution was altered to give the Prime Minister well-nigh absolute powers, I smelled the ghosts of ancient empires in the air, in that city which was littered with the phantoms of slave kings and Mughals, of Aurangzeb the Merciless and the last pink conquerors. I inhaled once again the sharp aroma of despotism. It smelled like burning oily rags. But even the nasally incompetent could have worked out that during the winter of 1975-6, something smelled rotten in the capital. What alarmed me was a stranger, more personal stink, the whiff of personal danger, in which I discerned the presence of a pair of treacherous, retributive knees. My first intimation that an ancient conflict, which began when a love-crazed virgin switched name tags, was shortly to end in a frenzy of treason and snippings. Perhaps, with such a warning pricking at my nostrils, I should have fled, tipped off by a nose. I could have taken to my heels, but there were practical objections. Where would I have gone? And, burdened by wife and son, how fast could I have moved? Nor must it be forgotten that I did flee once. And look where I ended up, in the Sundarbans, the jungle of phantasms and retribution, from which I only escaped by the skin of my teeth. At any rate, I did not run. It probably didn't matter. Shiva, implacable, traitorous, my enemy from our birth, would have found me in the end. Because although a nose is uniquely equipped for the purpose of sniffing things out, when it comes to action, there's no denying the advantages of a pair of grasping, choking knees. I shall permit myself one last paradoxical observation on this subject, if, as I believe, it was at the house of the wailing women that I learned the answer to the question of purpose, which had plagued me all my life. Then, by saving myself from that palace of annihilations, I would also have denied myself this most precious of discoveries. To put it rather more philosophically, every cloud has a silver lining. Salim and Shiva, nose and knees, we shared just three things: the moment and its consequences of our birth, the guilt of treachery, and our son, Adam, our synthesis, unsmiling, grave, with omni-audient ears. Adam Sinai was in many respects the exact opposite of Salim. I, at my beginning, grew with vertiginous speed. Adam, wrestling with the serpents of disease, scarcely grew at all. Salim wore an ingratiating smile from the start. Adam had more dignity and kept his grins to himself, whereas Salim had subjugated his will to the joint tyrannies of family and fate. Adam fought ferociously, refusing to yield even to the coercion of green powder. And while Salim had been so determined to absorb the universe that he had been, for a time, unable to blink, Adam